is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
A very warm welcome to you on the Country Hour. Yes, indeed, Warwick Long joining you. Not in the studio today, on farm. We're on a, well, I'm looking at a lot of sheep grazing in front of me on a property between Nagambie and Longwood. Here in central Victoria, I suppose you'd call that. It's a big field day today, turning knowledge into practice. It's run by the Australian Holistic Management Cooperative. We're at Jim and Donna Winter Irving's property. So what have they tried to do? How do you make money out of holistic farming? What are some of the value adds that are coming to the industry to help producers do that? Does farming a different way stack up for different kinds of farmers? We will talk through all of that and more. You can join us. You can send the text. You can be a skeptic if you'd like. I know many of you like to be. So do it. 0467 842 722. Let's talk about all of this whilst we've got the experts in the field together on the Country Hour this afternoon. I can actually see them walking back towards me after being out in the field, kicking some dirt just before. I stayed here to get the technical equipment working, but we will talk about what they've been speaking about on the program together. But we're going to start far away from here first on the Country Hour, though, and we'll talk about when mining and farming come to a head. Farmers in northern Victoria are concerned that a proposed mineral sands mine could put their crops and land at risk. Mining company VHM says it has discovered one of the world's largest rare earth deposits in the small farming town of Lalbert, south of Swan Hill. It's proposed to mine 1,500 hectares of agricultural land and build rare earths processing plant, which it says could inject hundreds of millions of dollars into the state's economy. So what are farmers concerned about? ABC Mildura reporter Elsie Kennedy has been looking at this and can join us now. Elsie, welcome back to the Country Hour. Let's start with the basics, shall we? What are mineral sands and why are they worth so much?
G'day, Woz. So mineral sands contain a couple of pretty valuable minerals. They've got critical minerals, titanium, zirconium and rare earth elements mixed in there. And some of those, particularly rare earth elements, are really in demand at the moment for some new technologies like wind turbines. They're used for the magnets that make the turbine run. And also electric vehicles have some of those magnets in their components as well. So just this one plant is proposing to, according to VHM, the proponent, it's saying it is worth a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars for the Victorian economy. And there are a couple of these mineral sand mines in the works potentially in Victoria.
So take us then to the farmers in this Lalbert community. What's their response been to the VHM proposal?
Yeah, so this proposal, VHM released their environmental effects statement towards the end of last year, and farmers had, at the time, 40 business days to put in responses to that. There were 181 responses, and the majority of them were against the proposal. So a lot of farmers spent their summer really getting their heads around what this proposal would mean. And what's happening at the moment is that farmers and also experts are speaking to an independent panel, which the Victorian government has appointed, that's hearing from experts and farmers in Swan Hill this week. It was also hearing last week, and it'll go until the end of the month. But so I guess farmers had a couple of different concerns, but I might let them speak for themselves. This is Nola Bennett. She's a farmer who is right next door to the proposed mine.
It's so renowned for being probably the best cropping ground in the Southern Mallee. There's retention licence from here to nearly Swan Hill. That's a lot of grain growing area that's going to be sacrificed. And if it's not successfully rehabilitated, that's gone forever.
So that's one of the main concerns, is this is a cropping region. There is a fair amount of land that they're talking about turning into a mine, and I guess there are a few other concerns as well. So some people have raised concerns about how the mining company went about talking to people in the community. And again, I might just let them speak for themselves. This is Don Lethbridge, who's, again, one of the neighbours of the proposed mine.
What happened? We were taking a silo bag off the machine and wrapped around my feet and bang.
Yeah, tipped him aside.
Broke my leg and my hip and my arm. And
yeah.
So anyway, that's all right. So they go down there, patch me up and welded me together and all that sort of caper. And while I'm down there, and this other bloke come in twice, wanting me to sign an access agreement so they could go and dig holes. And I would not have the bar of it.
Yeah, he's just talking about the mining company sent representatives in while he was in hospital with some pretty bad injuries, asking him to sign legal documents, giving them access to his land. And he's told the inquiry in a submission that that was a pretty vulnerable time in his life. So, I guess he's raising some concerns there about the way that the mining company went about doing that process.
So there's concerns from Don there talking about at a time when he was in poor health, but there's also concerns from farmers about what this mine could mean to their own health though too, isn't there? What's that about?
Yeah, so there's a few different concerns. So one of them has to do with within the mineral sands mix, there are those critical minerals, but there are also some radioactive elements. So there's uranium and thorium that's in the mix there. And farmers are concerned that once you start mining, but also processing that mineral deposit, they're concerned about what effect those radioactive elements could have on the health of the farms around the area. This is Nola Bennett again.
We have rainwater tanks as our water supply for everything, for drinking, eating, cooking, washing, and all of our rainwater is harvested from the roofs that are going to be covered in radioactive dust from a processing plant that's processing radioactive material.
Yeah, so that was Nola Bennett there just talking about some of those concerns. But there are also concerns in terms of that product will then go into the water system. There are some tailings dams, which are essentially where the wastewater will be stored. And one of the other farmers I spoke to is Leanne Poehler. She farms with her husband, Peter. Again, she's another neighbour of this proposed mine. And her concern is what happens when they've had some quite big rain events in that area, and she's sort of downhill from the proposed mine. So she's worried about what happens if there's a really strong rain event and that water potentially breaches from the mine and travels onto her property. This is what she had to say.
Every now and again, such as in 2011 and 2022, we've had large rain events. The soils get saturated with the water and then it hasn't got anywhere to go, so it runs downhill or downstream. And it comes off the Canny Ridge and some of it comes into the east of the property here. We would think that our crops could be at risk.
There's some concerns there coming towards the mine proposed for mineral sands at Lalbert, south of Swan Hill. Elsie Kennedy's with you, talking through all of it at the moment. What about the company behind this Lalbert mine, VHM? What have they been saying, Elsie?
Yeah, so VHM has said that they're not actually going to comment while the hearing is underway, but they did have some experts speak to the panel last week. And I guess in relation to those concerns around radiation, this is what Peter Hondros had to say. He's a mine radiation expert.
For the public, from the operations itself, the highest estimated dose was about 1/5 of the annual limit. For impacts to flora and fauna, the potential radiological impacts are very low compared to the screening levels. The radiological impact to grains is assessed to be minimal because the project-originated soil radionuclide increments are within the analytical error bands for existing soil radionuclide levels.
Can you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so that gets a little bit technical there, but essentially what they're saying is that they've done their own modelling and they reckon that it's all going to be within safe limits and there's nothing for people to be worried about there.
So what about the locals themselves, Elsie? Like, obviously, we've heard from the farmers that are concerned, but is anyone supportive of the project around the Lalbert area?
Yeah, there are. So I guess particularly the conversation around how much money this mine is going to be bringing into the community, people are, you know, one person I spoke to in particular, that was the manager of the Kerrang Exchange Hotel, Rob Sutterby. He says that, you know, this region really has a dwindling population. Agriculture is becoming more mechanised and that means people are moving away from the area. And he says, you know, his business is struggling and he thinks this mine could be a really good thing for the region. This is what he had to say.
We really need a labour-intensive type work to come to this region. Goshen's talking, 500 jobs the first couple of years and 300 for the next 30 to 40 years just for that one project.
Yeah.
So he's, Elsie, well, continue.
Oh, no, that's all. He's supportive of the project, and he's not the only one.
So what's next then, Elsie? What's next for this project?
Yeah, so at this stage, what's going to happen is the hearings are continuing until the end of the month, and then that panel is going to write a report to the Victorian government, and the Victorian Planning Minister will then it'll be up to them to decide whether or not this particular mine can go ahead. But there are a number of mineral sand mines in, I guess, exploration and planning stages in Victoria. This particular one is going to be going to a decision by the minister, but there are a few that could potentially get up in the next couple of years.
Elsie Kennedy, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Woz.
If you want to read more about that story, you can head online right now to abc.net.au/rural. That story from Elsie went up on the weekend. A lot of concern in the community about that mineral sands mine proposal, and a lot of big figures, a lot of money being talked about in that area as well. So if you'd like to read that, abc.net.au/rural. You're listening to The Country. I might have heard some of the hubbub in the background. People have returned from the paddock. And a fast getting lunch into them at this event today. We're at the property of Jim and Donna Winter Irving. We're at a Turning Knowledge into Practice event from the Australian Holistic Management Cooperative. So what is this farm? What does holistic management mean? What does it mean for markets? How does it all work in practice on the property as well? We're going to be talking through all of that right now, but we need to start with the property that we're at today because it is gorgeous. There is sheep right near us. In fact, there's a crowd of sheep around the bathrooms. It makes it look like there's an almighty queue in the paddock next to me, but it is gorgeous. There's green, tinge of green still on the grass around us. Plenty of feed in the paddocks. Plenty of people walking around. The shearing shed has chairs aplenty and looks like somebody's going to be up on the boards doing a talk there soon. I noticed a little hawk or something up on top of the dead tree next to me before. It's pretty idyllic. It's the property of Jim Winter Irving. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Warwick. How are you?
It's a pretty nice place you've got.
Yeah, well, it is a nice day. I'd probably like a few grey clouds with a little bit of moisture coming down, but we'll take the sun.
It's a problem when you're a country hour presenter and you talk about it being a nice weather, don't you? There's always someone wanting rain as well. Take me to your property as well, and Donna, I'll ask you about this as well. But where are we and what do you do here?
Good question. We're 12 kilometres west of Ngami. I know what the actual area is called. I think it's Monier, I think it's the actual name. So we're a grazing enterprise, 650 hectares. It's sheep breeding enterprise, and our son also adjusts some cattle on it as well, which started 2 years ago.
And what, Donna, I might bring you in here then too, because there's a beautiful display inside of some of your previous farm planning, some of it involving a napkin and then deciding sort of what to do and where to go from here. What have you tried to do? How have you tried to operate this farm?
So that's a bit of a school project. Kept me up till all hours of the morning. But it's just highlighting the journey we've gone from Jim being on the farm through with family, the importance of family, to me coming in from a different direction with horticulture, permaculture, and then holistic management, and that pathway of tools. There's wonderful people here who've been so generous in their knowledge in sharing with us, and us sort of setting the bar till we'd like to be there.
Yeah, so it's literally gone from drawing out your paddocks on a napkin and deciding what you want to do where,
yep,
to in there's a big sort of piece of paper that's outlining when your lambing is, when your shearing is, what paddocks are being grazed when, and I'm not doing it justice because there's so much more information on there. It's become quite precise over the years.
Yeah, I think, and it's gone from that, you know, pen and paper to digital, particularly with our children, our couple of sons who said, what are these things? It's just paper stuff. So let's get on technology. So fabulous. We can have, recovery times for paddocks in our pocket on the Maya grazing app. So it's just showing that being open to knowledge, but also farming's such an isolating thing, hence the shirts we're wearing today, which
They're
is all
beautiful.
About mental,
yeah,
mental health. So we make sure our life is pretty balanced, but in all this pathway for us has involved a lot of people, you know, at least a dozen or more people who've helped us and been generous. And particularly today, which is a beautiful showcase of food from some of the panel that are going to speak later, they're local producers. It's all about real food and real soil. And Just a bit of a celebration of that, but we're buggered without the soil.
Well, actually, we're buggered without the soil. It picks up exactly what I wanted to ask you both about, because so much of the focus of how you farm and what you do here has become about the soil, hasn't it? When did that happen and why?
Don's probably better to answer this, but we've got to manage the stock under the ground.
You should have left the microphone with her there, didn't you?
I should have, but I will answer it, because... you've got to manage the stock under the ground as much as above the ground, with all the biology and the insects and the worms and all those things that are happening under the ground. We've got to manage those as much as the stock on top of the ground.
I suppose I've got to give a shout out to David Arnold, who was my permaculture teacher. And he said to me, Donna, you need to do this. You need to do holistic management. That was about in 2015. What the hell is this? And so I started to explore. And then fortunately a course came and we did that. But I will say, I had to say to Jimmy, how many times, Jimmy?
Four.
Will you do the course?
Four.
How many? Four. Will you? And that challenge for a lot of farmers to get off the farm and get back into the classroom, because a lot left, hated school, didn't work for them and didn't bring out the best in them. And so they're a bit frightened to go back and learn. But this just changed their life. And as you said, you wish you had done it 20 years ago.
So how did it change how you operated this farm?
You're not in tractors very often. We know about life balance, in tune with nature and ecological, always thinking about adding life, not killing something, going out, always having something growing, making your workplace and your property beautiful. The animals are just a product, but we're just trying to grow grass and get those four ecosystems of water cycling, solar cycling, mineral cycling, the dung, and community dynamics, diversity of plants and bird life and everything, all functioning really well. And, you know, we're now pretty proud we've achieved the ecological EOV verification.
So you
say that our land is trending forward.
So you get tested on that.
And
you've got to prove, rather than, you know... We'll talk about this in a moment, but rather than being sustainable, keeping things the same, you need to prove you're doing better than
sustainable,
that.
Sustainable, I hate that word, Warwick. It means you're doing something, you're maintaining. If that's wrong, why are you maintaining it? It's adding life and improving, regenerating everything, regenerating ourselves, even regenerating your community around you.
Can you make a profit while you're doing that?
Yeah, well, I won't beat around the bush. Most farmers will have an off-farm income, and we do have others, but... And also where you're at in your life. We have four sons that are pretty much self-sufficient now. So rather than, you know, going on the overseas holiday, we might be putting in natural sequence farming contours that will cost you thousands. But for us, that's what we think is important. We're really passionate and close to the environment.
Jim, I've got a question for you, because Donna was saying, oh, you know, I came out here and that led to ideas, and then four times you got asked and then you got dragged out to this course. What was it like for you to have the sort of longer standing connection to the land and then change what you're doing and see that change?
I think I always had those sort of feelings in the back of my mind that, you know, are we doing the right thing here, putting chemicals on weeds and that sort of thing. I thought that I just didn't synthetic fertilizer. It was just something I think in the back of my mind I wasn't really in tune with, and probably thought it wasn't the right thing. So there were a couple of key things that I wanted to change. And there wasn't a defining moment when I did change, but it was probably, especially after I'd done holistic management courses, probably where the biggest change happened. And after I'd done one day of it, I couldn't wait to get to the next two and three, and it was a pretty exciting time. Yeah.
What does it mean for the future of the farm too? If you can see things sort of improving from here, what does it mean in your mind for, you know, you're thinking generations ahead?
I think it's something in time we'll be handing over to our boys probably, and it'll be in a better condition than what it is when I first sort of started. We've had one succession and we're actually sort of thinking about what the next one's going to look at. But looking after the land and making sure it's in a better situation or better place than when we were here, and how we leave it.
Well, thank you both for hosting us here today. It's absolutely great to let the Country Hour just rock up and plug in and have a look at your sheep and everything over the fence. But it's been great. Thanks so much for joining us on the Country Hour.
Thanks, Warwick. Get on to this tribe.
It's Donna Winter Irving and Jim Winter Irving, our hosts today on the Country Hour. We're out literally beside the shearing shed, looking out at the paddock where everyone has just returned from. They had a dam walk earlier, been out in the paddocks. And now they're coming back for lunch and then a bit more of a conference here. It's an event run by the Australian Holistic Management Cooperative. Helen Lewis is with that cooperative and can join us on the program now. Helen, welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks, Warwick.
When we say Australian Holistic Management Cooperative, what are you?
So the Australian Holistic Management Cooperative was formed to enable thriving lives and landscapes based on holistic management, which is it's ultimately decision-making based on values, grazing management, land planning, and some financial planning. So it's a holistic management is a management framework with values-based decision-making at its core, and which is, you know, speaks to the balance that Donna was talking about earlier. It talks about finding a way to actually enhance and enable those ecosystem processes of water cycle, mineral cycle, energy flow, and community dynamics to thrive. And so we're always looking to do working with nature and just trying to, you know, it's about regenerating land.
So you help farmers, and you help them through their sort of the programs to get accredited for the work they do?
Yeah, so we're supporting people in their implementation of holistic management. But even if people aren't directly involved with holistic management, they can, they haven't done a course, but they're wanting to regenerate land. We can offer support because we have an access to 25 plus educators in Australia. We're providing education support. And we're also, we often offer the ecological outcome monitoring. So annual monitoring of landscape function. If the landscape function improves, people can obtain ecological outcome verification. With that verification, we're one of the 50 hubs globally for Savory Global, and they can be part of the land-to-market supply chain and or have the land-to-market seal. And that land-to-market seal backs up has a chain of custody, so it backs up the claim that this food and fibre is coming from land that is regenerating.
So people can get accreditation, and the idea being with some form of that accreditation or attaining that seal, they can get a premium.
Well, a premium, but also, I mean, maybe it's not necessarily a premium, but it's actually market access. And it's, you know, people who are into regenerative, who are regenerating their land and producing product which is predominantly chemical-free and it's clean food, they are really passionate about other people actually getting, enjoying that clean food. And so being able to have a supply chain which is actually getting to the plates of those people who enjoy the clean food or wear the fibre, that is really, that is actually a key value. And so by having those supply chains in place and enabling that land to market, literally, or land to food, like land to plate, is really important for people.
Let's test a few things, because I know looking at our text line, some of the questions that come in around this, and I've asked a bit of that with Jim and Donna just before. But first, when we say regenerative agriculture, because that's what a lot of your programs are built around, right? What is regenerative agriculture? What's the definition there?
So I guess we talk about sometimes, I mean, sustainable is just sustaining what we've got. It's the status quo. It's sustaining what we're doing. Whereas regenerating land is improving. So it's actually improving. And a lot of that, it just comes down to making sure the tools we're applying is improving our soil health and our biology and actually building everything up from the bottom and from the soils.
And when we're talking regenerative then in this form, in what we're talking about here today, when we're talking about what you're doing, a lot of it is focused on the soils?
Yep.
And it's soils?
Well, it's also just applying the tools well. So we have, you know, there's technology, there's tools in our toolbox. So there's technology and there's grazing and there's living, you know, other living organisms and it's also managing time of grazing, etc. So it's the way in which we graze. Are we grazing so we're actually allowing adequate recovery? Are the tools we're using, are the technology we're tooling bearing ground? Is it poisoning land? Is it deteriorating the landscape? Or is it actually making it thrive? So we can use technology to which is, you know, anything man-made. So it can be our biology. We can put biology out instead of fertilizer, you know, chemical fertilizer or artificial fertilizers. We can actually enhance our landscapes.
Is it a profitable venture being in regenerative agriculture?
Well,
Can farmers do this make money?
Well, I think the input costs are, because you've got choice and because you know how landscapes function, you can actually choose which tools you choose to use and the way in which to use them to get the best possible outcome. And as a result of that, you can choose whether or not you pay the money or not. And you can still get benefit because we can use our animals to restore landscapes, particularly in more seasonal environments and even in humid environments. But it means that we're actually using our animals. They're our money maker, but they're also our key tool.
And that's the next question. Is regenerative farming at this stage only for livestock and grazing producers? Or can, say, dairy or horticulture or other businesses be involved in it too?
No, there's a lot of work happening in the horticulture, dairy and cropping areas. I mean, there's lots of great initiatives happening around cover cropping and no-kill cropping. And, you know, there's great examples across Australia of people doing lots of restoring and enhancing landscape function across industries.
Is it just for the rich?
No, I don't believe so. In actual fact, most people come to it when they're against the wall.
Really?
Yes. So a lot of people actually know they have to make a change and they come to holistic management and or they find, like they do a course because they don't know what else to do because they've actually they've really found conventional agriculture very expensive. So a lot of people make the change when it's financially required.
There's quite a lot of people here today too in terms of numbers. Is it a growing movement?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I've been involved for 25 years. So it's it's just growing exponentially.
I know why you roll your eyes so much when I ask you profitability and regenerative definition, and you've been doing it for so long.
But everyone's on a different stage of their journey, and I think it's really important that there's no right or wrong. It's actually what's important for the person involved and their context, their values, their vision, and so it's about their own progress towards what they want.
Now, you're based in Queensland in the wonderfully named town of Warwick, and you're part of the Australian Holistic Management Cooperative. So you have a good sense on this. Where does Victoria sit in the regen space then? How big is regenerative agriculture here compared to other states?
Oh, I think there's lots of good work happening across the country, actually. But, you know, no-till cropping. There's all sorts of good organisations. There's holistic management. There's a variety of different bodies that are doing some really great work. Biodynamics, the organics movement, there's a lot of ways people can get involved.
It's been fun to test some of these myths with you, to talk about what you're doing and just to be out in the sunshine. Helen Lewis, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
There you go. CEO of the Australian Holistic Management Cooperative. Let's go to rural news right now. We'll be back with more from this farm here just near Nagambie. Jane McNaughton has rural news for you. Good afternoon, Jane.
Good afternoon, Woz. It sounds lovely out there in Nagambie this afternoon. Making rural news today, a University of Adelaide study has found inconsistency in water laws between states is making it more difficult to prevent theft. The study started after Australia's Inspector General of Water Compliance described the existing powers as ineffective. Associate Professor Adam Locke says the water in the Murray-Darling Basin is valued at $100 billion, and he says theft negatively impacts all communities.
And effectively, if we can't prosecute people, stop them from doing this in the basin, then essentially we're all worse off. Our food costs go up, our rights are diminished, our confidence in the basin and its programs is all shattered, etc., etc. So, and that was really what he was worried about.
New South Wales local land services are warning producers to be on alert for locust activity around the state. If left unreported, the pests can have devastating impacts to crops and to pastures. Mel Leeson is the Project and Programs Officer with the Local Land Services Invasive Species Team, and he says recent seasonal conditions have led to an increase in populations.
They are on the move, and there has been increased reports from locusts over the spring and summer period. We were aware of small, low-density populations throughout the central west and out into the western area for the past couple of years, but it's either seasonal conditions or pastoral conditions haven't been ideal for those low-density populations to build up. But this year, with more widespread rainfall in those areas where they persisted, the numbers have built up, and they are sort of moving across the central west and western areas at the moment in reasonably low-density swarms, but they're starting to build up in numbers.
And you mentioned a bit of rainfall, before. Would we call this a bit of a plague? Is that what brings this on?
It can be in the right conditions. It's more about the feed resources that are available. And obviously, if you can have feed resources, it's usually on the back end of good rainfall. They do rely on soil temperature and moisture in the soil to breed successfully. So when eggs are deposited in the ground, they won't develop unless they've got two crucial things in temperature and moisture. But through that spring and summer period, you can have multiple generations of them. They'll persist in one area usually and build up bigger numbers unless they're controlled.
And staying in New South Wales, where authorities are investigating the discovery of hundreds of butchered horses at an alleged illegal knackery in the state's south, but the case has raised more questions than answers. Wagga Wagga City Council said it was leading the investigation with New South Wales Police and other agencies after reports horses' carcasses had been dumped around a dry creek bed near Wagga. It said more than 500 horses appear to have been slaughtered over a long period of time. Adrian Talbot is the man at the centre of the allegations of the illegal knackery.
They came out to inspect alleged 30 or 40, which would be closer to the number. For Bill Thompson to say 500, it was blown way out of proportion, way, way out.
Why are these horses
here
in the first place?
Look, I've been buying horses 20 years. And when horse sales are on, I take horses. The different horse sales. People bring a lot of horses to home as far as, especially like on the racing side of things, like I've been placed on an excluded list because there's nowhere for people, for owners, strappers, trainers to send their thoroughbreds. There's that many rules and regulations in place, they just can't do anything with them. There's paddock fools of them sitting around everywhere, getting neglected because there's nowhere for them to go.
So how did these horses die?
So they were euthanized humanely by a licensed shooter. For my own purpose, or my own pet food. I become involved in the Brumbie side of things. So rules and regulations with the Brumbies through the national parks is that the guidelines, you need a slam shut gate, take a minimum of 5 horses. I drive up there, take the truck up. With the facilities at home, I can load 1 horse, I can load 2 horses, I can load 10 horses. So people would come, phone up and take horses or I'd deliver them.
I mean, were any of those horses, these Brumbies, were they among the ones that were euthanised?
There was which national parks are well aware of, because you have to state where they go and what the destination of them is. There was a handful of older horses. There was one that had one eye that needed veterinary attention that they probably shouldn't have been sent down either.
Snowy Mountains Brumbie Group President Diane Hardley says she wants a full investigation.
Well, it's not surprising. It's been a well-known fact right throughout the Brumbie community and Wagga for a long, long time. It was brought to our attention a couple of years ago. On the 4th of July last year, we sent an email to Atticus Fleming, the head of National Parks, and the RSPCA with welfare concerns over a registered rehomer where these 500 horses have been found. And once again, no action, no investigation. The numbers of horses staggered me. The thing that upset me too was the fact that some of those carcasses were recent. And, rehoming is still part of the management plan. We've been waiting for horses, for a load of horses, and have been told twice this week they don't have any. If he got 500 horses through national parks, where's the paperwork? Where's the paperwork?
And that's today's Rural News.
Thanks very much for that, Jane. Jane McNaughton there with Rural News. Let's get the weather information before we come back to the farm here. Bri McPherson is a senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. Bri, it is sunny. It is dry. I made the mistake of saying it was beautiful weather earlier. Got corrected quickly by the farmer saying a few mils of rain would be nice. So what's it look like this week for Victoria's weather?
Yeah, look, it is about perspective, isn't it? So today and tomorrow is dry and sunny and even relatively warm. So temperatures in the low to mid-20s in the south and around the mid-20s in the north today, but a little bit warmer again tomorrow, up into the mid to high 20s in the north and the mid-20s in the south tomorrow. So above average for this time of year. Not expecting any rainfall or even much in the way of cloud at all today and tomorrow until a cold front comes through on Tuesday night. For those looking for rain, though, not an awful lot with it. So once this cold front comes through, we're going to go back into a pattern of just southerly flow. So the showers staying on and about the south side of the ranges again. But even then, they're not very strong cold fronts. So in terms of total rainfall over the next week or so with those, you know, the southerly flow and a couple of week cold fronts, we're still really only looking at sort of 0 to 5 odd mils in the south for most places, maybe a bit higher, maybe sort of 5 to 15 about some of the exposed coastal locations, and then also that area sort of around the Yarra Ranges down to Wilson's Prom that gets a bit more in this southwesterly sort of flow. They might get 5 to 15 mils there. Pretty much not much expected at all in the north. Maybe the odd shower will like drift north of the ranges when the main front comes through on Tuesday night, but not an awful lot in it. So remaining fairly dry in the north and only a little bit of rain coming in the south. But I guess the other thing to note is there's plenty of smoke around today with all the burning off being done both by the fire agencies and some private burns. But for anyone thinking about lighting a burn at home tomorrow with those, you know, those clear conditions, it's just a heads up that it will be drier and actually really getting quite windy ahead of that front coming through on Tuesday. So just a watch out for anyone thinking about doing a private burn. It will be getting quite windy. Our fire dangers are a little bit higher tomorrow as well, kind of the last gust for the season, getting up into the high fire danger risk through western and central districts before we go back into that cooler weather.
Hey, Bright, really good point, actually. If I look around me here, you can see some of that smoke haze really settle down even around the trees everywhere, and I certainly noticed it driving south of Shepparton today. So that is a good warning to everybody out there. Thank you very much, Brian McPherson, Senior Forecaster there at the Bureau of Meteorology. We are between Ngambie and Longwood, I'd suppose is how you would say it today, between the Goulburn Valley and the Hume Highways in northern Victoria, at basically looking at holistic management of farming. It's an interesting chat. There's a lot of people eating their lunch at the moment in the shearing shed on chairs. The spread of food is incredible. I think you've heard about that earlier, but local lamb and beef, local salads, local flour into bread, local peaches, and it looks pretty good. I'm missing it all, though, to talk to you about it. That's my commitment to you here on the country. I'm one of the producers, really, and it's sort of that next stage that we're going to talk about now. We started with Donna and Jim on the farm. We talked about the Holistic Management Co-op and their certification process and the idea of regen farming as well. And I can see some of your texts coming on that. I'll get to that. There's actually sort of next stage. There's next stage processing. There's next stage market access discussion, really, that we're going to have a chat about now. But I've grabbed Ian Congdon from Woodstock Flour. You're an hour and a half, a couple of hours away from here up at Rutherglen, and you're processing the grain into flour. How did you start doing that, Ian? Let me turn your mic on. There we go.
We started, my parents were growing organic grain up at Berrigan, and me and my partner, Courtney, we were looking for a way to come back to be a part of the farm because we see that as the way that we can have the best impact on, you know, our community and the greater world. We saw there wasn't a lot of people milling. There's just the big mills and then there's people at home and there's sort of no one in between. We started out with a little mill going to some farmers markets, and then one day someone from a bakery said, look, we'd take a ton a week of that stuff.
That changes your life.
And we could only do 40 kilos, and it took us a long time. There was that interest, and it just happened to be a good time, and the time in our lives we were looking for something to latch onto and really hitch our wagon to, I guess, and that was, we just went all in, I guess.
First things first, did the processing and going into flour, has that kept you connected to agriculture? Has it connected to the farm and the whole idea of where you wanted to be in your life?
Yeah, well, it's allowed us, we now buy nearly all the grain that my parents produce, and so, and at a premium price. And it's also allowed us to move off the family farm and onto our own block. And so that we wouldn't have been able to do that without flour.
Yeah. Is there a risk? How, just in terms of, you mentioned somebody coming up to you saying, hey, can I take a ton a week? And you're like, I'm only doing 40 kilos. Is there a risk then of being too successful, almost getting too big or having too much demand? Is that something you've had to manage?
We've definitely had, like, been in the very privileged position, I guess, to be managing demand the entirety of our, while we've been running this business. And so that's been at some stages because we didn't have the milling capacity, and at other stages because we didn't have the grain in the silo to mill. And at the moment we're at capacity of what our mills can do.
So does that mean you've got a waiting list?
Yeah, we've got a waiting list of customers. And so we basically, the way we prioritise who's next on the list is whoever's closest, because freight's a killer for all of this sort of stuff. And it takes, yeah, it takes away from what we're trying to do, I guess, is trying to create a community.
It's amazing that you have to think about that kind of stuff though, right? Like, you know, oh, we've got a waiting list. How do we decide, oh, you're close, that will work well for us? That's a good position to be in.
Yeah, it's very good, I guess.
And Ian, I hope you don't mind me saying this, you're quite young. A lot of the people in and around even a field day like this are quite young today. You don't see that at a lot of agricultural type events. Is there something different about this form of farming or this form of what you're trying to do, next stage processing, that's enticing younger people to agriculture? Or am I reading too much into it?
I think there's definitely in that next stage processing, it's a pretty accessible way to get into it with a more, like, you have more control than farming. And so for us, we have our business that we can have the more control of, and then our farming side is, there's more, way more risk involved, but there's also more upside potential. But I think the two balance themselves very well, especially when you're starting out and you need that, like, you need something regular that you can rely on.
This is the big picture question. Has it been what you thought it would be, going into milling flour?
I don't know whether we thought too much, to be honest. It's been really great. It's been amazing in terms of having that relationship with the end users, from bakery owners to people who are just feeding their family.
Your flour is here, really, but it's been made by a bakery.
Yeah.
So that's one of your customers has supplied the bread here. That's incredible.
Yeah, and yeah, we're really good mates with that, you know, the people from that bakery, like Josh in Tinto and Beth and in Shep. And yeah, so those guys, you know, become your friends and they inspire you, and it's easier to go and, I guess, do things a little bit differently when you know you've already got support from the other end.
And so I suppose when you're thinking about organic production of grain and you've effectively become the next stage processing of that, a lot of the discussion here and a lot of the scepticism that I see on our text line is around, oh, yeah, these are great ideas, but it's for the rich because you can't make money out of it, right? Like, that's a question. But are you seeing, especially with the processing, especially thinking of how to get that, how to find those customers like what you're doing, is that the key? Is that the access to market that even producers like those we're at the farm of need to find?
Yeah, I think you got to be careful by saying that that's the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. And you don't want a system where that's the only way to do it, because you need the different players and the scale of food production. You can't expect everyone to do everything all the way through. But it's definitely a window, it's an opportunity. And yeah, I think it's something that lots of people could try and see if that's your cup of tea.
Ian, it's been great to have a chat to you here. It's been great to have you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ian Congdon there from Woodstock Flour at Rutherglen. He's passing the microphone off to our next guest, and it's that idea of Ian's mic dropped and walked away, and I like that. I like that. It's 11 to 1. Certainly does feel younger here in terms of a group at a farming event, and that is interesting. It's just something I'm noting. I'm not saying whether it's good or bad. It's just something interesting worth looking at. Our next guest is into finding market access and finding homes for produce, and has it really an interesting story to tell. Serenity Hill can join you here, and I'm lifting up from the Open Food Network. Hi, Serenity.
Hello.
When we say the Open Food Network, how do you describe it?
Well, the Open Food Network is an online platform and an organisation that's been, we've been going for about 10 years now, supporting smaller scale producers to reach retail customers. So we're kind of working in that alternative supply chain sort of space.
And this is the questions you've just been sending here while I've been talking to Ian, that people have around profitability if someone's doing regen farming or trying to farm differently and have sustainability. Is there a demand, firstly, from customers? Do you see that through the porthole that that people want to buy this stuff?
Yes, there is a demand. I must say that recently... with cost of living pressures, it is very difficult. So we have these peaks of, like, in COVID, we had this amazing peak of everyone was excited about, you know, discovering where their food came from. So I think the challenge as an industry is to be able to keep those customers engaged and to do things where we can deliver a quality project, quality produce at a price and meet the needs of different customers.
Mm. And you've just launched a regen portal, Discover Regenerative Food Portal.
Yes.
Is there interest in that from producers and those who want to buy the product?
Yeah, well, we're actually just preparing to launch. So we'll be launching in a couple of weeks. So perfect time for producers who are listening to Google Discover Regenerative and to find out about coming on the portal.
So how will that work in your mind?
Yeah, so it's not a kind of e-commerce platform. Like, people don't come and, like, buy directly from producers, but it's basically about showcasing regenerative producers across the country, putting their best foot forward. There's an opportunity. Instead of being another, like, credential or another certification scheme, we're trying to be one place where farmers through the Australian Holistic Management Cooperative or other certification schemes can kind of, like, be in one place.
Show their wares. But yeah, then do you launch the customer effectively to them?
Yeah. Yes. And then it's a place for wholesale buyers and other retail buyers and anyone interested to come and browse through regenerative producers across the country and find out how to get their produce.
So Serenity's got her lamb and it's connected through the porthole. A producer can be like, I need lamb, and they can click through and find you.
Yes,
and
that's
then
right.
Negotiation takes place, and, you know, if it's Warwick's beef, it's same, but it's going off to me, not
that's
you.
Right. So it might go to the individual website of farmers, or it might go to our, you know, our Open Food Network site to buy directly. It's a showcase of producers.
Regenerative agriculture, obviously a big discussion point, and I can see it even from our text line. I can see it from discussions like here today. There's a big crowd here today. We're on a farm in the middle of nowhere. But, like, do customers know what regenerative farming is? And is that a term that's going to be known to people who are consumers?
I think it's there's a buzz about it, and it's getting to be known more and more. And part of what we're trying to do through this portal is to really reach people and make it a simple thing. Like, this is what we mean. This is what it feels like. This is what producers can deliver who are regenerative. I think there's a big risk at the moment for greenwashing. There's a lot of pickup and interest for, you know, taking the term and having it mean other things.
So it's sustainability. It's on the front of nearly every packet you buy from a supermarket.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is what we're trying to do through this portal is, like, this is, like, quality producers who've got credentials or have got their evidence up there so everyone can see. So we want to make sure it's only truly regenerative producers on there.
And are you pitching this more at, say, like, wholesalers and food service?
Yeah, so that's the kind of, that's the aim. I mean, obviously there's producers on there like myself, who will be reaching retail customers, but the big aim is to be drawing more. There's a lot of interest from us, particularly smaller businesses, to buy from regenerative producers.
So Serenity, you're probably a good person to ask this question of then. A lot of people in agriculture have a view on what regenerative farming is.
Yes, it's lots either, of people have an opinion.
It's either the future of agriculture, or it's what saved people's businesses, as we've heard some stories today, or it's something that you can't divine and you're never going to make a profit. Like, that's the divide there. Doesn't look to be many people in the middle when I look at the text line. How do you bridge that divide? And does it matter to bridge that divide between conventional and regenerative agriculture?
I think it's kind of horses for courses. Like, I'm not trying to get anyone to move across to regenerative. It suits me and my farming and a lot of people that I kind of talk to. To me, truly regenerative is about increasing ecological kind of function and outcomes at the same time as producing kind of awesome food. That's what it's about. And it's also about kind of longer term risk management instead of those highs and lows. Like, that's why a lot of particularly smaller scale farmers are attracted to it, I think. Yes.
Serenity Hill from the Open Food Network, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's go to markets now. To market. Let's go to Pakenham Cattle to start off, and Brendan Fletcher.
G'day. Warrack numbers fell to 820. That's 1,015 fewer, with the usual buying group operating in a cheaper market. Quality declined with few prime cattle penned. Young cattle eased from 10 to 30 cents with quality an issue. Grown steers lost 20, bullocks eased 5. Manufacturing steers slipped 30 cents. Cows gave back 20 to 30 with processors loading cows for an estimated 270 to 450 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls eased 5 cents. Vealers sold from 256 to 376. Yearling trade steers 270 to 340. The heifer portion 240 to 280. Grown steers 270 to 320. Bullocks 280 to 331. Heavy Frisian manufacturing steers 198 to 202. Crossbreds 230 to 300 cents. Most light and medium weight cows 80 to 228. Heavyweights 150 to 240. Heavy bulls 230 to 268. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Let's go to Mortlake and Chris Agnew. Take it away.
Thanks, Warrick. Numbers came back considerably to 1,000 head at Mortlake, a decrease of 1,761. The offering was very plain and mixed. Not all the regular buyers were present and active in a market that was very soft over most categories to be 20 to 30 cents cheaper and more in places. However, categories like the grown heifers and grown steers, they remained firm to slightly softer. All feeder cattle were 20 to 30 cents a kilo dearer, driven by local interest. Vealers made between 280 and 355, trade steers and heifers 250 to 318, and the grown cattle topped at 326. Manufacturing steers sold up to 245, and the heavy beef cows from 200 to 262 for one pen. The medium weights between 130 and 185. Covered dairy cows were generally between 170 and 215. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
And lucky last on the cattle run is Wagga Cattle and Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. The market for heavy export cattle, including cows and stock suitable for the trade, was impacted by bigger numbers and a shorter trading week. In a yarding of 5,000, the export market saw a price correction of 30 to 40 cents. Prices for heavy cows were traded between $2 and $2.22. The middle run of leaner types, $1.55 to $2. Bullocks sold to weak demand, $2.40 to $2.80. Heavy kill steers were also back, $2.40 to $3. Medium weight feeder steers, they held their value well, 290 to 374. The lighter weights, 244 to 360. Feeder heifer prices did fluctuate wildly at times, with prices back 10 cents. They ranged from 222 to 320. Trade heifers, 240 to $3. Lightweight heifers to background were back 30 cents, 202 to 282. And light store steers back to the paddock, 240 to 360. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Lucky last is the Bendigo Sheep and Lamb Market Report with Jenny Kelly.
Good afternoon. Big pullback in numbers with just 7,430 lambs, half of last week. Agents said farmers didn't want to sell into a short week with Anzac Day on Thursday, especially after the price haircut here last Monday. Prices did bounce back up, light lambs $5 to $20 better as numbers were slashed. Trade and heavy slaughter lambs $10 to $20 dearer, with rates moving back up into the 6.65 to 6.90 cents a kilo mark, with occasional bounces over 7 bucks for really well-presented shorn tradies. Export lambs over 30 kilos carcass weight, 210 to a top of 236, with not a lot of big lambs available. More of the lead pens are in the 26 to 30 kilo range at $165 to $223 at a ballpark cost of 6.70 cents. Heavy trade lambs, $156 to $177, the best group averaging around $6.80. lot less light lambs under 22 kilos today, and these picked up at between $80 to $130 for the decent types. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Jenny. That's about all the time we have for you on the Country Hour today. We'll be back in the studio tomorrow, although if the weather keeps this up, I'd have to find somewhere to be. Thank you very much for all your texts. I know I didn't get to them all today. I might even try and make room in the program for them tomorrow. Interesting discussion from here. We'll bring you that more of that tomorrow. We'll also talk about the amount of lambs going from west to east. They are huge numbers doing that at the moment. That's coming up for you tomorrow on the Country Hour as well. Have a great afternoon. Listen to the podcast wherever you can get it. And we'll catch you soon. It's 1 o'clock.